It's ad break time. I'm proud to announce the Beyond Solitaire podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they're up to some amazing things. Their next game, Hydrologic Cycle, is currently on Kickstarter, and you should absolutely go and check it out. CLGS also continues to offer classes in partnership with Gen Con. The next course, Jason Fury's Crowdfunding with Confidence, starts on May 6th and will teach you all about board games and crowdfunding. Go check it out. And I'll also include a final plug for myself. If you like the show and want to support it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. Thanks to listeners like you, I've been able to keep upgrading my equipment, subscribing to StreamYard, and more. But for now, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire. And this week on the pod, I have a very special guest. This is Eduardo Garcia Molina. He is a graduate student at the University of Chicago in classics, yes?
Yep.
And I'm just super happy to have you on the podcast because you are an expert on archaeogaming, among other things. So why don't you tell us like the basics of what you do and then what archaeogaming is for people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thank you for having me on. I'm super excited. This is a great break from, as we were talking about a little bit before we started recording, the dissertation kind of fatigue that I'm currently experiencing as I near the end. So I'm doing my PhD in classics, specialization in ancient history. I mainly research the Seleucids, which is one of the Hellenistic empires that formed after Alexander kicked the bucket. One of the bigger ones, don't tell the Ptolemaic historians that. And actually got into them through gaming, because I didn't know about them at all until I played Rome Total War. Way back when, oh God, my age is the como se dice, the gray hairs are already forming as I recount the story, and I always recount it to my students. But I played Rome Total War, and I picked a faction. They're called the Seleucids, who are these weirdos with their huge roster, their OP roster that had cataphracts, they had elephants, they had everything, and that naturally snowballed into a fascination with them afterwards. So even in my main research area, I've always carried kind of gaming into it. And then as I kind of developed in graduate school and I started noticing that there's this community of scholars that are incredibly invested in looking at games, not only through like reception one-to-one, but also how game mechanics, how the world itself that are in video games can be examined as an archaeological or through archaeological terms, through archaeological lenses. And kind of the niche that I am currently in, that I have a chapter in an edited volume coming out, I think this year, possibly. It's one of the things with academic publications. You never know in what state of limbo one thing is until it surprises you in your inbox one morning. For example, I'm super interested in kind of questions about, in my broader research, questions of state power and state infrastructure. So I'm very invested in kind of transplanting that interest into the gaming world. So I've looked at how ancient states are represented in kind of ludic frameworks. So like in grand strategy games, how the power of an ancient state is translated. I like that word a lot because game mechanics, you know, you can't just look at it and critique it as a historian going, oh, that's inaccurate. No, you have to think about how it works in the kind of ludic environment. That's kind of the broader and then the particulars of kind of how archaeogaming or how my research kind of conforms and fits into the greater scheme of archaeogaming.
So archaeogaming as a term, I've only started to hear it recently. Is this something that's older than I realize it is? And when people use it, what are they trying to communicate?
There's different facets of it. I mean, it really got popularized into kind of the academic verbiage with Andrew Reinhard's publication, where his book is just titled Archaeogaming. I forget the subtitle afterwards. But it's really, it can be applied to different things. The one that you see it most often is that I mentioned before, kind of examining ludic environments as an archaeological space. Like, you know, looking at how inscriptions are. So for example, in como se llama? Oh my God, I spent my fourth year of my when I was supposed to be writing my prospectus, Elden Ring, like the inscriptions in Elden Ring. None of my dissertation committee is
it's okay. I spent my whole dissertation year writing and then playing Skyrim all day, so it's okay. It's normal.
I'm bouncing around between like Civ 6, turn-based games where I can, you know, write a little bit, take a turn, and go back to it, which is an unhealthy kind of life balance thing, but that's just how it works for me in writing. I think that's like the meat and potatoes Archeo Gaming, but even then, there's other broader umbrella of like reception stuff under it, I would categorize it. But yeah, I think that's the main one, is just kind of examining these gaming spaces as kind of archaeological spaces in of themselves, but also kind of the meta, like ET cartridges in the middle of the desert. There's also that aspect of like material culture that's very pertinent to, you know, our lived in environment as well.
So you mentioned that you got interested in the Seleucids through Total War. As you went from Total War enthusiast to history enthusiast, how did your feelings about the game change? Like, I know you wrote a chapter about this, but I mean, on a personal level, was that upsetting or broadening? Or, you know, what did you notice first about things not being quiet as you would have thought from playing the game?
No, that's actually a neat question, because honestly, I've always divorced I've never had that like knee-jerk reaction that you see a lot of like Total War Reddit about, like historical accuracy, even though it's very superficial historical accuracy. Some of the claims that are being levied, so for example, like Lorica Segmentata idolatry, when, you know, the stuff like that, like I've always managed to kind of divorce the pleasure centers of playing from the historian brain. I know some people can't. I'm very gracious that I've been able to, and I can just enjoy a game, and then I can just turn it on if I'm like, you know, if I'm looking at it through an academic lens for a presentation or something like that. I can also just sit back and like go, okay, flaming pigs against counter my elephants in Total War. Sure, even though there's only one mention of him in, you know, I forget what a tactician and the CEs. Once the dates start counting up. My interest starts waning. I'm a good old BCE man. But stuff like that, like, I guess I can appreciate also just how much devs mine historical accounts more for, like, their inspiration. I guess that's one aspect that it's a positive aspect. So I've never had that, like, negative persnickety, like, oh, they're doing it wrong. And like, sure, but, like, I'm more fascinated by like, oh God, they like mined Plutarch for this random quote that he said about this one battle, and then they turned it into a unit or like a game mechanic. I'm more interested in like how they mine the historical record for information, and I kind of get giddy. And I've been talking with modders about this for that chapter, but also for an invited lecture that I gave in California. I wanted to kind of incorporate how modders kind of, you know, tried to flesh out the rosters in Rome, in Total War Rome or something like that. I think one of the modders I talked to was from Rome Total War Surrectum, I believe is the name of the mod. It's on Steam, the workshop right now for Rome Total War Remastered. I forget the number of factions, but it's an insane number of factions that they fleshed out. And a lot of them are mentioned like three times in like, I don't know why I keep going back to Plutarch, but I don't know, Livy, let's go with Livy. and they like flesh out an entire faction based off of like these unit mentions. Like they really do their homework. So I'm kind of fascinated in that more than just like the, the Marian reforms. That's another flat point.
So actually, I wanted to ask also, What is your? How do you feel as a Hellenistic scholar about the fact that your obsession is with a game called Rome Total War?
Oh. I mean, you get used to it. The Hellenistic period is really treated as like a middle child. You don't have, you know, Periclean Athens, you can't rest your laurels on that, pun intended. And then you have Republican Rome just taking over the conversation. You don't see people on TikTok posting about how they think of the Hellenistic empires every day, as much as I would like that. But it's one of the things I kind of talk about in that chapter, because it also triggers something in the players and how the game develops notions of imperialism based on Rome, because Rome is kind of seen as the endpoint of ancient imperialism. Oh, this is imperialism perfected. Romanization, the big ization things, and to a lesser extent with the Hellenistic empires, Hellenization, these problematic ization things that academics have largely eschewed. But a lot of the imperial frameworks are Roman based and then grafted onto not only the Hellenistic empires, but even the Alexander expansion. The Achaemenid Empire is given this Roman flavor of imperialism, where to kind of the meat and potatoes of it is just building service kind of these cultural conversion things. So you demolish other cultures' buildings and you replace them with your own culture's building, and then they kind of become this font of, they're even given numerical thing, which I find absolutely fascinating. Every turn your city gets 3% more Hellenized at the expense of local cultures, when in actuality that's just not how people work. We can don many hats, and ancient empires didn't want to, unless super necessary, you wanted to keep local sites of worship intact, because that can help you if you give the temples money, and they can, and the priests can go, oh, this new guy is our, he's great, he gives me money, they can help in the translation of local gods and deities over to the Roman deities, even though the Romans were famously your deity, oh, this is our deity, okay, there's a little translatio going on. But stuff like that, a lot of the city stuff, everything's very urban, because the interface demands it, because heck, if you were Rome Total War II, oh god, the naming conventions when they switched up the, what is it now, Sega, Total War Rome II, I think is the way that you're supposed to say it now. I don't know, Rome 2, they try to introduce this you have your capital and then you have your little villages to kind of help out, but it's still very weird way of looking at the empire, that it's just cities and villages, and these villages are pretty high up there also in terms of population and everything. So the density of rule is very focused on the urban, and then you have this demolition thing, so it's very build up buildings. It's very, and for the image that I used for the beginning of that presentation, and this was at Long Beach, CSU Long Beach, where I gave this, because they have we were talking about gaming archives, they have a gaming archive there also. And the image that I used to kind of start off that presentation was an AI generated image of what a Roman city was. And you just see, the trad accounts on social media think of the Roman Empire, right? It's all columns, all pristine white statues that are self-replicating. It's exactly that. And Rome kind of has that same, Rome 2 and Rome 1 kind of have that same buildings, build, construct, aqueduct, urbanity. This is how empire is done. When, ancient empires just didn't work on that Roman mindset. They articulated themselves in a lot of different ways, because just ancient states didn't have the same capabilities that a modern nation state can when it does empire, right? So they had to be creative and kind of, power sneaky. I just wrote about this actually for the dissert, for the introduction. One of the words that I very much, chameleonic. That's how ancient empires worked.
That's super interesting. You mentioned, not only did ancient empires not work you know, like Rome did. Rome is not the model for everybody. But also, Rome doesn't work the way that we make it work. So what does it say about us? I feel like that's where your paper was going. You know, you talked about things being Weberian and talking about like religion as being seen as a specific kind of cultural influencer. What do you think the scope is for us to use? I mean, obviously you're studying classics and the focus is on the ancient world, but how much freedom do you feel to like kind of push into, well, what does this say about us? Like, it's the mirror of Herodotus, but we're looking in it.
Yeah, no, I think that's, it says a lot, actually. And that's one of the things, because it's easy to just, como se dice, it's easy to just, you know, wave it off and go, oh, this is just, you know, ma. No, but it actually articulates how a lot of us perceive of it, you know, if it, you know, if we're not invested in kind of just reading this horribly dense literature on like ancient statecraft and all that, that is how we naturally see it, because it's what's more human than kind of looking at something and then trying to articulate it based on, you know, what we or either have experienced or at least know about, or is at least, you know, more modern in a sense of like 19th century, 20th century imperialism that still very much leaves an impression on us today. But I think conversely, it can be used to great benefit to kind of have. So, for example, I introduce this in a lot of the classes that I teach, not only because gaming is, you know, it's way more accessible. It's a lot of my students that I've taught in classes like have experience with the ancient world through gaming in one way or another. It's a really good bridge to kind of talk about the problems, not only in historiography, you know, the writing of history, how we look at ancient states and how we kind of these modern systems and then try to jam them into, you know, an ancient framework that just didn't operate on the same function of strong, weak state power. But also it can get us talking about like archaeology, like, because a lot of these things are interrelated. So, for example, this fascination with buildings as like these power generators of culture has to do a lot with how how we treat material culture. Oh, there's a Roman temple here. Ah, the Romanitas must have been up the wazoo. The Romanization must have been, you know, so prevalent, when like people can just walk into a space translated based on their, like, that's just not how culture and like and identity works. We're much more malleable, all of us, and the ancients were no less in that regard. So like it can get us talking about some like actual problems with the field and how we treat things like buildings, heck, how we even view the ancient world, because I talked about the kind of top-down perspective in that article. In video games, right, and especially in grand strategy games, you have a top-down perspective. You just see like cities, maybe you see some villages, but it's basically just like these islands of urbanity and then like these little constellation of villages every once in a while. Then after that, it's just like they may throw in a resource to kind of make the map a little bit, you know, more interesting visually. But that also reflects how very often in the archaeological record, because of the nature of excavations, right? We can't excavate everywhere. Area surveys help with this regard a little bit to try to get at more village life and rurality as opposed to urbanity. But even then, like, we're kind of, we're largely left blind to kind of what is occurring out there, you know, away from the centers where we excavate. And these are more often cities just because, you know, resources invested in it. There's a lot of, you know, the infrastructure behind archaeology and archaeological expeditions. There's a lot to be said there. But again, these games can introduce us to kind of these like heavier conversations. I say this as my cats decide which one's going to the window.
I'm enjoying the show. It's all good.
but yeah.
So I think it's really interesting. You mentioned that there's a couple ways we could branch with this, but I'm going to start here. Sure. You mentioned talking about this with your classes. And I will say, so it's really fun to talk to you because you are about to graduate from the University of Chicago with a PhD. I did my undergrad there from 2004 to 2008. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever brought up things like Rome Total War or video games or any of that in any of my classes. And I think that I would have been delighted. I feel like academia is kind of changing to become more open to stuff like this. But, you know, as somebody who's just gone on the job market, you're like doing the professional launch now. What role do you feel comfortable allowing RQ Gaming to play in your scholarship? And how is it being treated? Like, you and I share some of the same professors. You know, are they changing too? Like, is this like, is it people who are kind of in our age bracket who are bringing it in? You know, how, what do you see?
I think it is that. So it's still in the department. I one of the second years and first years is into it, into, you know, Archeo Gaming and then looking at this these kind of topics through that lens. But in terms of like the department overall, I think I'm usually the outlier. And it's one of the things, because when you start teaching and you start, you don't even have to like, so for example, I was a TA for a Greeks of course. And we would have lectures with the professor. And then the second class of the week would break off into discussion groups. And then the class would, from 60 people, we would split off into two discussion sections, and I would lead one in another room, and the professor would lead one in another room. And even if you just put in your slides, as you're having these discussions, like a background image from Rome Total War or something like that, you will have a student afterwards like stop you as you're exiting the room. And you have all your graded papers and you're, you know, hating life and hating the paperwork aspect of it after a wonderful discussion. And they'll start talking to you about like Total War and all that. But you don't even need to kind of boil it down to these, like, even though I relish these human components, but also in terms of just professionalization and how to posture yourself. For example, the department that I'm joining, at Urbana-Champaign, the classics department there has a really strong reception component. A lot of the professors there do reception. And naturally, I fit in very well into that kind of dynamic. You start seeing these kind of older professors that have done reception for a variety of things, you know, classical reception on a variety of aspects, and they start to more and more appreciate this kind of growing momentum that's occurring in the incorporation of Archeo Gaming, the incorporation of game studies into kind of conversations that classics has been having out classical receptions for ages. So you start seeing that kind of them being more receptive and more interested in it, because not only, you know, their own interest in reception, but it also opens up departments to a lot of new students and a lot of new opportunities to kind of cross-collaborate. So, for example, the Urbana-Champaign has a game studies component to it that I can naturally see myself building a class to kind of talk about more this interested overlap that I have between, you know, historiography, archaeology, and the aspects there, and also, like, game mechanics and how they're implemented in the ancient world. So I do think that there is a kind of growing acceptance and a growing, viability to kind of incorporating these discussions. But as in everything, in classics, but also just in academia in general, it has a lot to do with how receptive the individual departments and the people there are. But I feel relatively comfortable in saying that it is becoming more widespread as people start to recognize that, oh, you know, these conversations are salient. They can be used not only in their own, but also to kind of introduce people into these greater questions that we're having in ancient history and in classics. And it also, Another angle to get students invested in what we do is never a bad thing. For example, I taught here at Chicago Intermediate Greek 3, which is based on Homer. And I did it, we read through book 6 and, you know, in ancient Greek. I led them through Homeric Greek. We did it every week. And then the last class of that week was dedicated to not only the Greek, but also looking at a translation of the passage that we spent the week reading in the ancient Greek to see how, you know, translators handle these words. And for 1 week, I gave them the option of either reading the Iliad comic book, or they could watch a video. Because that's one of the things about archaeogaming. That's one of the problems in how to incorporate into the classroom is you never want to presume that everyone has ready access, even more than academic books. Mm-mm, you do not want to presume that everyone has the funds and the ready access. So this is another kind of, not a negative, but a thing you must consider is like, do you have a game lab? Does your university have a game lab? Like, what are the resources that your university can use for you? Do you have to bring in your own resources? So stuff like that, never, ever think that students have ready access to this kind of material. So I gave them a video that kind of broke down Troy Total War, this fascinating, weird attempt at this like weird branching saga thing that Creative Assembly tried to do and has not gone over well for a variety of reasons. I think the Pharaoh is their newest saga one. Fascinating, the reception to that one. And I was like, okay, so instead of a direct translation, I want you to look at the factions and look at the bonuses, the faction bonuses that each individual Homeric character has been given. Odysseus has like the stealth, like it encourages stealth because, you know, tricky Odysseus, complicated Odysseus, a very famous recent translation. Online was a buzz over the fact that Odysseus can be called complicated. Oh, how dare you call him complicated?
It's complicated.
Even though the Greek reflects that. But yeah, there's different like angle of, even for a traditional, like you can't get more traditional than Intermediate Greek 3, reading Homer. But even then, like it invites people to engage with it on another, like some students at the comic, other students at the, that's fine. Because that foments student interest and they bring that interest back into the class discussion. I didn't have to do anything in that class. That's the best thing you can do if you're leading a discussion. Because the student, like, nothing is more rewarding and no class is more beneficial than a class where the instructor, if it's a discussion-centered class, of course, if it's a lecture, then you're doing something wrong. But if it's a discussion, like, Friday discussion class, you want them to go off on their own and do these things and, like, even bringing games into that allows for some to incorporate that. So yeah, I think it, overall in broad strokes, there is a heightened level of reception to, you know, game reception and incorporating that into kind of the toolkit of like ancient history and classics departments in particular. Yeah.
So within game reception, so we talk mostly about Total War, but mm-hmm. What other games have you incorporated into this aspect of your work, and what are the criteria by which you make those choices?
Honestly, just like personal fascination. I mean that's one of the things, you know, is that we do what we do based off of something in your brain going, oh, that's neat. And then you wake up like 12 hours later from the rabbit hole that you're in. Oh, God, what if I? Oh, no, that actually happened. I did a panel, archaeogaming panel for ASOR, another one of these like big academic conferences. And it was on Archaeogaming, and that one was on Pokemon. How the Pokemon games kind of use these ancient like visual cues to go, oh, this is old. Because that's one of the neat things about Pokemon, right? It began in Japan, and then it quickly became more and more globalized. So the game after game, they have to deal with a wider audience, and they have to now develop their own lore. So they're going, oh God, how do we make this more complex, but also manageable, but also complex, you know? So like, oh, ancient stuff. Oh, this temple, how do we make it appear? Oh, fluted columns. so a lot of like the visual cues in Pokemon are playing up. You also have like traditional Japanese, so it's a hodgepodge. I don't want to say like, oh, they're just doing, you know, fluted columns. No, it's a hodgepodge because it reflects Pokemon's, you know, growing globalization, that they have to talk to a bunch of people and they have to build this like conglomeration of antiquity based on different aspects. And one of those is, you know, Greco-Roman antiquity. So really, like in terms of the topics, it's really, that's one of the neat things about game studies is like, you will always have something to mine, and there will always be something new on the horizon. Like every morning I do my coin search. There's a Seleucid Coins Online hosted by the American Numismatic Society. And I just put in a random thing and I go, okay, let's look at some coins, see if there's any inspiration. Strikes, pun intended. But then I also open up Steam and I look to see if there's any Roman, Greek, to see if there's anything new that, you know, could possibly, I just found, I forget the name of it off the top of my head because I found it last week. And again, dissertation brain. It's this like, you know, indie game. It's a Doom inspired shooter FPS. But you play the role of the ghost of Caesar, who is coming back to get revenge on his assassins. But it's a Doom FPS, like, you know, blocky chunky graphics and you know, fast paced combat, and it's yeah, it's like
these. Does Caesar have good little taglines like Kaisu Tekdon? And like,
honestly, I have not yet played it. It's on my wish list. They have a demo up. If you search like, Konyo, I forget off the top of my head the name of it, but if you search like Rome or Caesar, it'll pop up on the newest Steam thing. I think they also did their own like heavy metal soundtrack to it, you know, as one must do for a Doom clone. But there's a lot of rewarding experimentation, and there's also a thriving mod scene that like, there's so much to be done. That's one of the things that I really want to incorporate more, you know, once this is done and, you know, I can get back to other projects, is to see how modders tackle this kind of stuff. But yeah, no, heck, and we were just talking about my growing now fascination with Magic the Gathering as I slowly sink into it because of these commander boosters, I forget what it's actually called, like Outer Worlds, or not Outer Worlds because that's trademarked, but like Expanding Horizons or something, where, you know, IPs are now being, decks are being made with different IPs, and the Caesar deck from Fallout got me into Magic. I bought it last week, and I also bought the Necron one because I'm a Warhammer guy, and Necrons are my favorite, even though they're more Ptolemaic based. There's not really a Seleucid faction in Warhammer that can be a, you know, but I'll deal with the Ptolemies. So there's like, there's just so much, and it's continually like evolving. There's always something new on the horizon, and there's always interest in it. And so I think like in terms of how I pick the stuff, it's really just what speaks to me. That's one of the great things about it too, is there's a lot of room. So everybody can have like, what's that super? Hades. Like I played Hades. I really enjoyed it, but it didn't like, I didn't feel the need to research it. You know what I mean? I could turn off my research brain and just like enjoy it as a thing. But other people are super ham on it, and they both enjoy it, and they see it as a research thing, which is great. I think that's also one of the great things about like studying games, but also playing them, is that it naturally leads to kind of these like paths. I know this scholar super into this type of like game, and they'll be super interested. So it allows for that kind of like branching path, more so than even like your bog standard academic researcher or something like that. Like, oh, I'm into information studies or whatever, what have you.
So video games are not the only kind of reception you do. We mentioned some of our pre-chat, and it's just sort of on your online presence that you're also interested in. For example, you told me that you have a chapter coming up about Cuban classical reception. Yeah. What other kinds of reception do you do, just for the people? And then also, how do you think that that links up or cross-pollinates with your work in video games?
So it's mostly those two. It's mostly like a Cuban reception and gaming reception. Both of them are informed, you know, by my growth as a human being. I'm from Puerto Rico. My parents are Cuban. My grandmothers and grandfathers are Cuban. Games have always been a component of my life. So it's one of these things where, as I research my primary area of research, which is nevertheless informed by my, you know, personal experiences. I mean, we just talked about how the Seleucids, I came across them in Rome Total War, and the questions that I ask about empire are nevertheless informed, but of course never dictated by the experience that I've had in Puerto Rico and, you know, under the U.S., seeing how the U.S. systems are in place on the island and how empire develops there. So it's those two aspects primarily. And in terms of like cross-pollination kind of with my primary area of research and stuff like that, they allow me to kind of ask question or bring in things that I can then ask questions about. So for example, my dissertation's very dry. It's on archives. I'm very interested in how people experience state archives and how, you know, the process of going into an archive, putting your documents, how that interaction kind of shapes Seleucid order. But kind of the second big project that I have is looking at the Seleucid army as kind of a force of acculturation, how, you know, bringing these disparate people from all over the empire into this singular body that then goes out on campaign for prolonged periods, very frequently. The Hellenistic kingdoms, oh boy. We think of the Romans as bellicose, but no. There was already enough bellicosity before they came into the picture. The ancient world was just like that. That second project is kind of looking how this force was a force of unification, of kind of social, cultural unification, because you're in this armed force. Greek is kind of the main way that orders get articulated, at least from the top down. You can have a guy as an intermediary, and you likely did have a guy going, hey, these are the orders, blah, blah, blah. But you have this like force that's always out there and bringing people together on campaigns. And a lot of that was brought on by, you know, looking at the Seleucid roster in Total War and thinking about how armies move and everything like that, but also like Puerto Rican soldiers in the U.S. Army, they wear the same uniform. You can't distinguish them, unless they're, you know, I have this one picture that I use. I presented on this. I gave a keynote on this in November. I have this one picture at the end. Where you have these soldiers, these Puerto Rican soldiers, but they're in U.S. fatigues, right? Because, you know, the army naturally forces you to adopt the costume of the army. Antiquity, less so, but still. And they're, you know, they're playing the timbales, guiros, and everything like that. They're playing, you know, local instruments. and the picture was taken in Guantanamo Bay. And so it's like, you know, you join this thing, you can be part of kind of the Imperial project. And so it's like, it's all these things. I think as much as my study of antiquity informs the questions that I ask about in the, you know, gaming studies, the opposite is also true, that a lot of the questions, or at least kind of the things that I pick up as I play, you know, naturally, you kind of let them stew, and you start going, it's one of those like long shower thinks where the water's too hot, you're probably burning yourself, but you're like thinking about this idea. And I've had a lot of those because of, you know, looking at kind of Puerto Rican Cuban material, but also like game studies, and you bring that into the research that you do. So it's one of these things that just like, you know, you compartmentalize it when you're on the job market or in your CV or stuff like that. But all these things are just interrelated. You know, it's the same brain. You're the same person. You don't like shut off the Seleucid. I don't don my Seleucid hat, or I guess more appropriately the diadem. You can do the petasos, I guess. Yeah, that's more Bactrian. fascination with headgear on coins is also kind of a thing. But also coins in video games is also a thing that I'm super into. So see, like, I work on coins. So it's always this, like, and I think that cross-pollination just makes you a better scholar. As long as you realize, you know, as you have to sum up different ghosts for each conversation, but still, like, you're a person at the end of it. And like, having this stuff is just a neat way to kind of think about it from a new perspective.
I like it. Yeah, I think it's very tempting. You know, I think when, especially when you're doing academic work, to kind of present as like, this is a very objective study that's based on this hard evidence. I'm like, okay, yes, there's evidence. Yeah. But every single person who does, especially, I mean, even if you're doing scientific work, you do it because it was something you were interested in.
Yeah.
Everything that we do is driven by who we are, in the sense that we're all going to gravitate towards what we like.
Naturally. Yeah. But it also, like, people have this perception, as I'm sure you know, that history is kind of this, like, particular histories, let's go with that, are objective. There's never, no, historiography, the very act of writing a history, no matter how, you know, 19th century Prussian you are about it, No. Every single time that there is a historical account being penned by an, even if you're living in the moment that you're like Caesar's battles.
Yeah.
You think he's impartial? No. Like, you just,
look,
even if
the
you
people
want
were
to,
happy, right? That Caesar knew what to do when he showed up. Yeah.
and now you have these people that think Caesar in Fallout, you know, is this like, he's not like a villain, because he's more insidious than that. Because the thing that he's selling in the Fallout games, the thing that he's selling is civilization. The problem is, and rule, and like order of law. Yeah, the problem is for whom. So it's just these thing where it has a lot to do with just the nature of the questions that we ask in or how we write histories has always been informed by like our life experiences. No human being is able to like detach themselves. You're not a robot.
Actually, yeah. No, I'm kidding. So this actually leads me to another question, though, which is, you know, the other thing is I find very, very interesting, especially about video games and reception studies, is that a lot of scholarship now is being sort of conducted by talking to people who are doing mods, talking to people who are on Reddit, looking at comment threads. How do academics need to adjust in terms of both their perspectives and how they engage now that, I guess, kind of like the barriers between, well, I'm an expert and I'm at this university and I know this research, like I know what I'm doing, but I'm also interacting with, maybe dependent on, lay people essentially for research interactions. How is that going to change academia? How's it changing it now? And how do we handle all of that in a way that's both respectful and responsible?
I think we've gotten, well, some have gotten better about it. I mean, you always see that post, "Hi, historian here," at the end of the thing. And it's already an appeal to, you know, I have read blah, 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 blah. And that's all fine and dandy. The problem is that a lot of these conversations also have to do with just the nature of the university itself and the kind of changing aspect of it as it caters, you know, as prices soar, as departments close and shutter, and you have not only, you know, but this term kind of has a pejorative, you know, the, como se dice, the armchair historians. You have people on YouTube that do video essays on this kind of material. But you also have, so it's not only, you know, again, I'm voicing the voice of the, this is not my personal, but I'm voicing the voice of the dismissive academic. You not only have the hoi polloi, but you also have, and you know, professors, but you have growing, and this is just an unfortunate casualty of just the nature of, you know, academic staffing and the job market. You also just have a growing number of people that are no longer in the como se dice, the rat race, or like, I don't know,
the traditional pipeline.
Some horrid roll the die system that is like academia. In terms of where you end up and land. So I think that that is another aspect of it that has greatly facilitated kind of bridging this gap. Unfortunately, because we would have these impassioned scholars in departments, but, you know, as universities do what they do and hypocritically shrink departments, cut everything down, become more business oriented and stuff like that. You start having this kind of third intermediary of people that have made it more their passion to bridge this gap. And I think that is a wonderful thing that is... Sorry, my cat is just randomly meowing as they're wont to do.
He's got opinions, you know, it's cool.
See, he put himself on the tippy top of the cat tower, so now he's, you know, he's lording over like the Eye of Sauron. in terms of kind of extending the hand or kind of having people more and more involved in these academic, you know, air quotes, discussions, you are seeing like conferences and workshops that are attempting to bridge this gap more and more. So as much, there's always a want to turn towards pessimism. And I understand that because, what, you spend 6 years, you know, more than 6 years. I mean, heck, I've been in this now 10 years since I started my bachelor's. And then I did my master's and now I'm doing the doctorate. Everybody, you know, we're passionate about this. You have to be. Because you have to be to subject yourself to this. So there's always this like knee jerk of, oh, people haven't been doing this for 10 years. So why? Who are they to say? Who are they to make this horribly informed video essay on this war or something like that? There are dark sides to it. Like some of these channels, like on YouTube and stuff, they get like,
oh yeah, we're in like fake news, creepy world. Well.
I've been seeing what they're doing, and like, are they paying their grad students that they're having write their scripts for them well? Like, are they? Because academia is exploitative already.
Oh yeah,
we don't need our graduate students then like a big YouTuber going, "Hey, write the script for me," and then not paying them. So there's always that also. But I do think in a kind of positive way, again, in the background of just like the university system is not crumbling, depending on who you talk to, crumbling or reorganizing itself into something more horrid. But like that also opens the room for more of this talking, back and forth talking, and like this kind of dismissal of the ivory tower for what it is. And again, a lot of that has to do with generation gaps also. We were talking about that when we started talking about like Argue Gaming, gaming study. A lot of that just has to do with generation gaps also. But yeah, I don't know if the cat now has the zoomies. So I don't know if I got to everything there.
Yeah. No, I was asked because, you know, I have plenty of like internal conflict about it myself, because on the one hand, I put the work in, you know, I'm a lab teacher. I know what I'm doing. Also, my PhD is in ancient Christianity. I've taught New Testament many times. So the number of opinions, very much Jesus. So like the number of opinions that people have about what my work, right, that I consider to be highly uninformed is high.
Yeah.
And figuring out how to balance between respect for other people, commitment to what I see as the truth, the fact that sometimes you do have to put some work in to have, you know, I mean, it's a really, really tough spectrum. And I feel like it's getting harder because we also now live in an era of like, well, I did my research and that means that I Googled something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, our perspectives are not the be all end all just because we researched it. There are plenty of people who come from anywhere who could have, I mean, you know, it's like the classic Goodwill Hunting, like go to the library.
What book do you get in the library then? Like, because that informs. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is no, I share your conflicting, because on the one hand, yes, we don't need this like you ineffable like academic person. You get these like academic superstars every now once in a while pop up. No, they're not infallible. Like just because they wrote a book on it does not mean, so I think the problem is that, yes, we should, like, that's great, because everybody should be questioning to different degrees what people are saying, because it's just the nature of it. Okay, what source did you use? Okay, what is that? The problem is that people go into source material and source criticism without the toolkits that, because they think, oh, history is just reading. No, it is, but it's reading. It's not like, I don't know, let me read some Livy, let me tell you this particular date. I mean, you still have that like modern thing that history is just a, and some people just want it to be that, an uncritical view, but that's just not how history does. But the problem is that people then go, ah yes, because I read this Wikipedia page, or I don't know, I read this one book on it where the author, and then you don't look at the footnote or the endnote. If it's a book, it probably has a damnable endnote. And a lot of, like, you start seeing, like, open access is becoming more and more of a thing. Some, I have yet to wade into the publishing water, so my ability to speak on publishing practices is a little bit, I've done some like talking to publishers, but nothing more than that yet. I'm still finishing the dissertation. So open access does help to, I mean, there's also sites where, you know, academic books can be gotten. I'm not going to say the sites, but there's.
Say, I might have a collection of very legitimate PDFs hiding on my Google Drive. You know?
Yeah, no, like, I've totally always gone to the library. Yeah, totally always made the physical effort to go to the library instead of, you know, convenience of finding a very popular book online. But yeah, it's difficult. And especially because, you know, as we know, history is becoming more and more, you know, like weaponized, like what is on authority is being more and more questioned. Because, you know, now it's not only your historian, are you a woke historian? Or, you know, as if, you know, no historian ever has again, it's just the nature of what people think history is. It's never been just this.
Yeah.
Even in the analytic tradition, it's a, what do you include in a date that happened and what you don't include in a date that, like, any single attempt to write down historical information is an act of, like, agency.
Yes.
There's never,
you exercise your judgment in some way.
Exactamente. Even on a subconscious level, even if you don't mean it. And that's one of the things that I think gets lost in this translation from, you know, popular history or what have you. You know, if you watch a YouTube video essay on, you know, I don't know, the Peloponnesian War or something like that, how are they framing it? What, in video essays, it's even more interesting. What images are they using? Because now you don't only have the information, you know, you don't only have someone speaking to you, but you have a kind of visual thing that goes with the audio. So how is that interplaying with the, there's a lot of different, it's great. That, you know, we have these sources on YouTube and people are producing this content. However, it is for YouTube. It is for, they become like these, like, mills for production of these things because there is actual finances involved in their production. Like, as much as we, like, question the History Channel and their dubious amount of content, YouTube historians are no less at fault in what they decide to talk about, what they don't decide to talk about, how they decide to talk about it. It's still a thing. Like, it's great that we're having this, like, it's complicated because it is, because that's just the nature of, like, you know, historical conversations. And the meat and potatoes problem is that, you know, the appeal to authority of the academic must yield to the fact that what we do is naturally, it's still our own production of it. So what we offer to the table is that we know kind of the nuts and bolts of how the, you know, the I'm so bad with these American expressions, how the thing gets made, how the sausage gets made. We know a little bit more about, you know, the trends behind it, how people have viewed history, like, historiography is a thing. I think that's one of the great things about kind of this is kind of why I'm so interested in game studies, is then we can bring out these greater historiographical questions into the discussion, aside from, you know, oh, here, the armor is wrong because, of course, the reform did not occur until that's great and all. Sure, there's a time and a place for that. But there's also, like, more substantial conversations that we can have about just, like, how devs, take history and historiography and kind of fit and translate it. I like translating because translating doesn't have, like, negative connotations. They translate it because they're not doing this out of malice. Of course not. Yeah. But they translated into kind of, again, a gaming framework and stuff like that. It's complicated. It's messy. And it's only going to get, I think, messier. Cause a lot of it has to do with, you know, the culture that we're in, you know, the woke wars part deux, part three, I don't know what we're in right now. And then, you know, the universities are crumbling. There's also questions about content on, like, on TikTok and YouTube, like, monetization. What does that do, you know, to history with a capital H? It's messy. But I think overall, I mean, you know, aside from the fact that universities are crumbling and everything, I think that the fact that the you know, social media and everything has made these conversations at least more, there's always bad faith actors. There's always going to be, there's them in academia. There's always going to be. But I think having more people in the conversation is never a bad thing. If the problem is then, you know, when people don't know, they go into the conversation mid-conversation. They don't realize that conversation has been ongoing since antiquity. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, but even like, within academia itself, like, we're forever in negotiation with each other.
It's always a conversation. Yeah.
I like it. So there's so much more we could talk about, actually, but I want to respect your time. So I will just ask the question I always ask people, which is what games have been bringing you joy recently? You hinted at it. We can gush a little bit here.
I mean, there's been a couple. What is this one called? I have it on my desktop. Age of Wonders 4. I have been playing a lot because that one is just a very nice, again, turn-based, because turn-based lets me think that I'm enjoying life and then go back to the dissertation writing afterwards. So I can take a turn and go, oh, dopamine. And then, or is it dopamine? Which, yeah, right? Yeah. And oh, fun. Oh, dissertation. I have now, in terms of kind of recent fascinations, Warhammer is looming on the horizon because the department that I'm joining has actually a fair number of people that are into Warhammer. And again, like when I was a teenager, I used to play a lot of it. Tomb Kings and Necrons. I know the ancient historian going with like the two most like obvious nods. Pero Tomb Kings, at least for the tall or for more ancient Egypt. And then I like my Necrons because at least modern Necrons are more Ptolemaic. I will die on this hill. Modern Necrons are more Ptolemaic in their regards. But also now, magic. I am very quickly developing an unhealthy habit with it, as it appeals to my like necromantic leanings. I just like, ever since I was a kid, I really like undead stuff, like spooky skeletons and all that. And black is spooky skeleton color, so I very much enjoyed that. And also, just looking at how, I was looking at them this morning, how in the Caesar deck, they kind of... So I initially bought the Magic the Gathering Fallout Caesar-inspired deck. Because I'm like, oh, I can look at it for like reception stuff. I tricked my brain into going, oh, you can make this into a work thing. And then quickly spiraled into not a worth thing when I bought the Necron deck, and then I'm planning to go with my partner afterwards downtown to get some card stuff. But, like, I don't know. It's really neat that, like, I don't know, they have Decimation, the Roman practice of... I don't know if that'll pop, show up on the camera, but it's Legate Lanius, Kaiser's Ace. And they have... They turned Decimatio, this like punishment, this semi-mythical, because of course we can nitpick about, was it actually implemented? Because a lot of Roman historians like to go like, oh, you remember when the army was so good and so like well-ordered? We still do this today with like the US Army. You still have these silly conversations about like, oh, you know.
Those were real soldiers.
The Roman army gone woke. Back in my day, the Romans did this exact same thing. There's always an appeal to, nostalgic appeal to the past. And the past is always like, everybody was mean and like farmers. And everybody was like, you know, more severe because they lived a more austere lifestyle than our decadent ways now. And, you know, Decimatio, yeah. You know.
You know, nobody wants to work anymore.
Yeah. One every 10 kicked the bucket. They pummeled the heck out of him. And then they turned it into a Magic the Gathering game mechanic. When Legate Lanius enters the battlefield, each opponent sacrifices the 10th of the creatures they control, rounded up. never expected that in my life, that I would see that. But it's super damn neat. So that's my current. I'm now super into Magic. And then eventually I will... I already have my Ptolemy-inspired Tomb Kings army, because now Warhammer's going back to the old world. Now they did that old world thing. So I'm very much looking forward to starting back my Ptolemaic-inspired Tomb Kings. And speaking of mods, there's a mod for Total War Warhammer 3 that introduces a new faction where you have just skeleton hoplites. And stuff like that. So there, if you want to, what is it? What's his name? Is it Harryhausen? I always get, right? Ray Harryhausen, the one who did the stop motion skeletons that's super famous, and he did like the stop motion Medusa. He did all this clay things. So if you want to do your like, I think it's Harryhausen. Apologies.
Ray Harryhausen. Like, yes.
You're Ray Harryhausen. Okay. It's one of those names that you think is fake until you say it enough. But if you want to like go back to your Jason and the Argonauts stop motion skeletons with, you know, the hoplite shields and the little things, download that mod. I feel like a Forgotten King or something. I forget who's the modder. Again, another instance where modding is great. But yeah, those are my current fashion. Magic the Gathering and then Warhammer will forever loom on the horizon as I can actually, you know, get back to painting and enjoying the hobby more.
Fantastic. And if people want to follow your work online, where can you be found?
Oh, I'm on Twitter. Why would you subject yourself to my puns? But I'm on Twitter. That's basically it for the moment. I have a blog, but I haven't updated in a while. Once I get, you know, all my writing focus has to go to the dissertation. And once that's defended, I can get back to, you know, some casual writing that I hope to get back into. But yeah, Twitter, and then I'm always up for emails or anything like that. I'm on the UChicago Classics, but as I said before, next year I'm going to be starting in a new department in Urbana-Champaign. So if you want to, you know, any emails or anything like that, any follow-ups, you can check on the class. I don't know my email yet. They haven't given me an email yet. So yeah, that'll probably be the best way to contact me is through there. Yeah.
Fantastic. I, of course, for those of you out there, can be found anywhere is Beyond Solitaire. Eduardo, thank you so much for coming on. This is an absolute delight, and I am very much looking forward to everything that you've got coming next.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is great. This is a really wonderful way to start a Saturday morning, actually. It's really nice chat.
And now I'll be sending you back to the New Brutalist Library.
No, all my things are online. I don't think, oh, Shiza, I think I do have to get a book. I have the tab open. Shiza,
say hi to the wonderful Regenstein Library for me.
Oh, I will. Domineering facade. Yeah.
And for those of you who are out there, thank you so much for watching or listening. Please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.